Joanne. It's always a privilege to be asked to do anything in AA, to be singled out for various pleasant duties and some unpleasant duties. But tonight's a pleasant one, and I've only been in contact with Clancy on a one-to-one basis a few times over the past number of years, and he spoke once at the anniversary of this world-famous Kingsway group about 11 years ago, I think it was. And we had a lot of fun then. And I have his cakes, which I'm sure many of you have. And as I told him, I was about to tell him that I'm very pleased that finally the legend has come alive and is here and present and touchable. I'm sure he can handle all this stuff. But I'm delighted to be asked that. Joanne says Jack's going to say a few words. I don't think Jack or I ever said a few words about anything. But on that happy notice, to remind myself that I'm not up here doing the retreat, I'm here to welcome our good friend Clancy. We've already done that on a one-to-one basis, and I ask you all enough to welcome Clancy I from Venice, California.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. I want to thank Jack for the introduction. Jack is, you know, I've talked on the way from the airport. He and Maggie were kind enough to pick me up at the airport. And just we got in the car in the airport, I said, "How's it going, Jack?" And he finished telling me just we pulled up here. the only break is when he one time he stopped somewhere and said, "Oh, hell, we're on the wrong road." We turned around. But Maggie's so brave. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm at a little bit of a... I know many of you people have been to this particular thing several years, and there are some people here new. I'm going to tell you something that may stagger you. I've been sober a long time, longer than Jack. But it's nice to see you younger people hanging in there. But this is the first retreat I've ever attended. I've never attended a retreat before. And I didn't want to attend this one because I've always had kind of a subconscious joking attitude towards retreats of, I know how to retreat, I'm trying to find a way to go forward. Now my sponsor, I didn't dare tell him that because he went to retreats and did a wonderful job. Old Chuck C. and the Paula Mesa retreat, of course, turned out into a book, finally. So, I've talked a lot about the steps in various times. And Mr. Grafton from Winnipeg wrote me a letter and said, "Now, you ought to go up and do that." And I said, "I didn't want to do it." And he said, "Well, you better do it." So I came up here. But I really have not been terribly comfortable because I didn't know what I'd find. You know, I come from a little Lutheran community in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I thought it might be Catholics up here. I don't mind them as a rule. I married one, but I practically single-handedly repopulated the entire Catholic Church with my efforts. I was unfortunately married before birth control became acceptable. And as I've said many times, my grandmother warned me about marrying a Catholic girl, and I told her that was a bigoted pre-war feeling. And I'd been in the Pacific fighting the Japanese so that we'd have no more bigotry and no more racial or religious intolerance. And I married this girl, and my grandmother was right. And it's not that she was bad, but there's something you never tell little Lutheran boys. If you marry a good Catholic, probably isn't true of bad Catholic, but good Catholic. If you marry a good Catholic, you're about to become the head of a rapidly growing family, whether you want one or not. And I used to plead with her and tell her that we didn't have to take orders from some old guy in Rome in a white dress, and she'd get nettled. She finally had a priest come by one time, and he gave me an hour and a half on the rhythm system, which is a Catholic version of birth control, and I listened intently, and I just couldn't get that beat. I just... I became a national distributor of small Catholics. people like me always don't have much hair in front because you go through life coming home and saying, "You're what?" So I have a little experience with Catholics, but not much with retreats. But I'm glad to be here this evening to discuss. Most of you, I'm sure, have studied the steps and have heard outstanding authorities on the steps. All I can give you is my personal version and my opinion and my feelings and what I've learned in the 33-plus years I've been active in AA. I'd like to start off by saying I've had no other therapies in the past 33-plus years. I'm not going to weave in other therapeutics. That's one of the great problems we're facing today in AA is the concept that people come into our meetings and want to talk about gobbledygook they're learning in other groups, in other therapies. And we don't judge in AA. We don't. We all do, but we say we don't. I don't judge, but I want to tell you this, you some bitch. You know? But the one thing I think we can do, we were talking about the way you come to the car. Sometimes people come into an AA meeting. Maybe it's in the session they'll talk about the difficulties they're having with their inner child or their how their parents, their alcoholism caused all this, and on and on. And there may be valid reasons, but I think it's valid to say, as we talked about the car, that's very interesting, but take that to the group and discuss it in the group that discusses those sort of things. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we discuss 12 steps and recovery. We do not, any more than I would go to transactional analysis and insist they work the 12 steps. They got their thing and I got my thing. You do your thing, I got my thing. And I don't want to come to an AA meeting and listen to someone whine for 45 minutes about their inner child. It makes me want to puke, that's all. I'm not saying your therapy isn't valid, but it isn't valid inside of our walls because our walls deal with the only successful treatment of alcoholism in history that has lasted very long. The Washingtonians had a successful therapy, many of them similar to our steps, some of their therapies, but they didn't survive because they didn't have any traditions. I'm sure some of you newer folks might not remember this, but there's only been two effective treatments of alcoholism in all of the 4,000 years of recorded alcoholic history. And one was started in 1840 by six guys in a bar in Baltimore, and they evolved a little organization that gradually grew, and very much similar to AA. They had they got little groups. This guy would go over there, that group and talk, and one would talk to another, and then individuals to individual, and very successful. By 1845, 5 years later, it was estimated conservatively that there were 100,000 sober alcoholics on the East Coast, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Washington, New York, Newark, Boston, and there'd never been anything like it. But they didn't have any traditions, and there were a lot of problems they were having. Who was getting the most newspaper notice by their talks, and who was the most successful in gathering new members, and who? And then they got into a thing, if we're this successful, and you'll hear this in AA today, if we're so successful with alcoholics, we should be able to change the whole world with what we're doing. And so they, little by little, worked into different fields. They had people, Washingtonians, who were abolitionists to wipe out alcohol all over the world. They had people who were anti-slavery, kind of the anti-slavery movement. There was one of the speakers in 1847 in Washington was a young congressman from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln talking about slavery. And on and on. And they got to work with narcotics addicts. Narcotics at the time, opium and laudanum. And they really expanded their message to everyone. And by 1848, to all intents and purposes, the group was extinct. There was a few people left. I remember I have a book home from a guy written in 1862 by one of the old line members. He lists all the places he traveled, all the speeches he gave, and how he said that something happened. He didn't know what happened, but they all left. They didn't have a primary purpose, a unity of thinking. But that was the place that they had steps and no tradition, not really steps. And these steps, as we know, came along. We know the history of this, that There were no steps written. And certainly when Bill and Dr. Bob got together in the Cyberling guest house in 1935, and there were no steps written when they got organized in Akron, or when Bill went back to New York, or when Clarence started a group up in Cleveland. And in 1938, Bill Wilson and this organization decided to write this book, hopefully to take some of the funds and start hospitals for alcoholics. And he wrote this book that I, when I was new, when I first went to my first AA meeting, I was sent to a meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. You think that's a long time ago? You weren't even born yet, you. I shouldn't be mean to the newcomers. I want to say this because to the young people, because sometimes we forget to say this. We get so caught up in our stuff. But I try to say to everybody who talks that in my group in Los Angeles is the largest group in the world. Some 1,200, 1,300 people every Wednesday night. Really up, enthusiastic group. Quite famous. And we have a lot of young people. I want you, I'll tell you what I tell the young people in our group. You are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And if you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. But they wrote this book, and when I went to my first meeting, and a guy asked me, I had a guy who was trying to help me, and he asked me to read the book, and I read the book, and I found it to be interminably dull. It's no kind of a joke around it. He'd say, "Well, I read that book, and it's just bad writing." It wasn't bad writing. It's just dull. And some years later, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I came off Skid Row, and I had a new sponsor, and he had me read the book, and this time, I read that book, and it was interminably dull. It just was an interminably dull book. It's just, all my adult life, I've been a successful writer. I write things and say, "Do this, buy this, take this action, move now, now." When you read that book, it just goes on and on.
If you are thorough at this stage of your development.
But over the years, I've come to believe that book is the only inspired piece of literature I've ever, divinely inspired piece of literature I've ever held in my hand. Because I believe the book is a miracle. I didn't believe that for many years, but I couldn't believe that. And I believe it's a miracle because the man who wrote it did not know enough to write it. He had no background in psychology or medicine or abnormal psychology or theology. And there have been all sorts of experts in the field working on this problem of alcoholism. And he sat down and wrote a book based on the observations of people, most of whom went back to drinking. You know, we keep forgetting that. We make it sound as though all the Christians on the catacombs stayed sober. Most of them didn't stay sober. And he wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 52 years, 53 years, than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. It's kind of interesting when you read about him. He talks about writing the book and how one of the hang-ups he had was how to put these principles down. And he lay awake at night and think, what the hell? And he said he's taking a nap after and said he just fell into place in his mind. He jumped up and scribbled him down. But I didn't come to 12 steps. And as we know now, our combination of things, principles in the Oxford movement and a couple other places. And these 12 steps have boggled the mind. They're deceptively simple. We've all heard them a lot of times. We read them at meetings. And it just doesn't seem to anyone with any intensity of emotions knew that this can possibly change your life. They're nice to talk about, but they have no meaning. They're like the Ten Commandments. They're nice on the wall, but what do you do with them? And that's why I'm glad to talk a little bit about them for the next couple days. If nothing else, if not to instruct you to at least revive within me a continuing memory of what they're about. And I think the first three steps, which we're scheduled to talk on tonight, I've always felt are the three most important steps in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they are the steps that drive people away. They drive people away from AA because they come here and, they just don't seem to have any meaning. You come here and you're desperate, your emotions are ripped up, and you know drinking is a problem, but you have so many deeper problems, and the feeling's just bad. And those steps are just, well, first you admit you're drunk, and therefore your life's all screwed up, and then you're going to come to believe that God's going to make it all better, and then you're going to turn it over to God, and it's going to be just fine. And there's a Spanish word we use in Southern California sometimes that maybe you've heard that fits that moment. It's just, adios. I got to find a little something more complex than that crap. And when I was in and out of AA for many years, and I knew quite a bit about it, and I read the book, and I knew all about it, and I knew, done a lot of things. And I had good sponsors who were decent and good people, not power drunk dictator people. I'll tell you, what I learned about sponsors over those years was this. Somebody new here, you might be looking for a sponsor. Find someone who uses the term, because it's so reinforcing, unconditional love. You want someone who's going to love you no matter what you do, even though they don't really mean it. You find out after a while, they get cross. But even they say, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but they all tell you sooner or later. So you stay away from them as much as you can. And the only time you really need your sponsors is after you drink. And you call up and say, hello, Bob, I'm sorry, but I've let you and AA down. Now, if you got a guy with unconditional love, you say, you haven't let us down. You're sick. You've had a relapse. That's all. I'm coming right over, and I'll get some of the guys, and we'll go through this with you. I'll bring a pint so you won't go into DTs. God bless you, Bob. That's what I call sponsorship. I wound up in Los Angeles with some old puke that knew nothing about AA. But you think like, kid, call me anytime you want, a night or a day. If you haven't got the money, call collect. Wait until the time you drink. But after you drink, save your money. All you're going to hear from me is a dial tone. Jesus, this guy don't know nothing about AA. But he was rather insistent, I do think. He insisted I read the book. I read the book, and it's stupid. So I didn't pay much attention to it, but at least I could tell him it's stupid. He's awfully testy. I guess I made him testy. It's like you hear about these dysfunctional families. I come from a dysfunctional family, but I happen to think later, I made it dysfunctional. Should have just let us sit it. I came from a dysfunctional family. I've been a victim all my life. Wherever I go, people hate me. I don't know why. But the first three steps of AA were to me a very difficult thing, because they seem to have nothing. They're just mishmash. And we all know that. We admitted we were drunks or powerless over alcohol, and that our lives had become unmanageable. And I remember discussing with my sponsor once on this subject, and he wheeled on me and got me thinking for the first time, and changed my thinking about the first step over a period of time, not that moment, of course. But I think the hard thing to remember is that we come here, and everybody knows the first step says you admit you're an alcoholic, and it doesn't admit you're an alcoholic. It doesn't even ask you to stop drinking. As my sponsor said, why don't you just try the black parts? I've said before, you know, he used to wave his finger in my face, and I didn't have any front teeth at that time, so it's the only time I really missed my front teeth. I wasn't going to give him the pleasure of gumming it, I'll tell you that. But he said, just take the black parts. He says, it doesn't say that. He says, you admit you're powerless over alcohol. You have some trouble with alcohol? and so on. And we talked about that. And what do I have to admit? That I've lost my power to control my drinking. And if I hadn't lost that power to control my drinking, I wouldn't be here. It really, the first step is non-debatable, because any either side of it, if you had not fallen into it, you wouldn't come here. People don't get up in the morning, one morning, and walk through the French doors into the garden and say, well, spring is here. I think I'll join AA. We come here under the lash. And the problem is sometimes we get thinking that we have to admit our problem is alcohol. And we don't have to admit that either. It says we've become powerless over alcohol. In other words, I can no longer control my drinking. And nearly everybody in this room lost that control long before they came here. And not know why. After you hear a while, you understand why. We keep fighting alcohol without realizing alcohol is not the problem. Alcohol is the relief from the problem. It has an unnatural relief tendency. That's what makes it such a remarkable and lethal thing. But all we have to admit, there's nothing debatable there. I've had some trouble drinking. Yeah, I have. And therefore, my life is unmanageable. But that's where my sponsor nailed me. He said, it isn't therefore our life is unmanageable. He said, there's a dash there. I don't know if you remember, as you're supposed to be a hotshot writer, but a dash in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. My life is not unmanageable because my life is powerless over alcohol. I am powerless over alcohol, and in addition to that, my life is unmanageable. Or in other words, I've lost my power to control my drinking, and I've lost my power to control my sobriety. That's all you admit. But if I hadn't lost my power to control sobriety, I wouldn't have to go to AA. I would just live in sobriety. All of us, I'm sure, have quit and realized that quitting is the painful part of the illness. That's what makes alcoholism to this day such a lethal disease. Why over 90% of alcoholics, as it's estimated in America, still die from alcoholism, or die drunk, after all the help available. Because it's the only illness in the world, one of the very few, of course, where the problem comes after you are withdrawn from the toxic substance. And then you live in agony. So all I have to admit, you go along, you get much more sophisticated in these things and discover the nature of the problem, something called alcoholism. And alcoholism consists of an unnatural reaction to alcohol, which brings about a feeling of euphoria following sober conflict. But there's nothing really to admit there. I mean, there's nothing debatable when you think about it. People read much too much into it. They have to think, they have to admit they're lifelong drunks, and if their problem is alcohol, then stopping, they're going to shape up, and they're going to change their lives. It doesn't say that. It says, I'm admitting I've got a problem with alcohol, and I'm admitting I got a problem without alcohol. It's just that simple. We'd like to read deep complexities and metaphysical insights, but that's all it says. I have to believe that's what he meant. Second step, however, gets a little spooky. There's no getting away from that. Because now you've got to return to God. And returning to God may be fun for some people, but not for sinful Norwegian Lutherans. As I've said many times, I was raised in a very, very strict church. Our dropouts became successful Catholics. It's been said, maybe true for all I know, Norwegian Lutherans, even if they're married for 30 years, would never make love standing up, just in the fear that some passerby might think they were dancing. It really is a dreadful church. And, I kind of liked the church. It was a good church. But I was weak and sinned and did terrible things. And I wish I could have been older sooner. Yeah, I think about that when I was young. I know what made me pop my mind now. This certainly is not prepared. I have my script, but it seems you've lost it. When I was a boy, like most boys, I was troubled by sexual drives and fantasies and urges. And when I was 15, I was on a ship in Pearl Harbor. I'd run away from home because I had a great lust for adventure early in the Second World War. And I found out later that on these ships they gave us all sorts of... what's that stuff? No. Huh? Not condoms, right? Saltpeter. Condoms.
When you're aboard a U.S. ship, you don't need safe sex. Well, clean there.
Anyway, what a terrible trip. And I've been afraid of retreats all my life, and here's the kind of people who are. Anyway. But they put saltpeter in our food. And I often thought about that. It never seemed to have any effect on me, because it's supposed to keep you from being edgy and nervous and fantasizing. I suppose some of the guys edge up to the messmen and I've actually eaten pounds of this stuff, and I was always fantasizing and nervous and sweaty and pimples bursting out and all that. But the odd thing about that saltpeter is this, something I never realized. I ate a lot of it, never had any effect, and it just kicked in about 2 years ago. If I only would have had that effect many years ago, I'd have been saved a lot of problems. Boy, I'll tell you. If that saltpeter would have worked, I'd have saved a lot. Christ, I might have gone to heaven. I was raised in this church. And I joke about it now, but there's something I'll tell you something. When you're raised in a strict church and you are kind of a bad person, you're a rebel or a sinner, as you say it, you can joke all you want about it, but there's just like the thing Hitler used to say. You give me their minds till they're 12, they'll be a part of them, they'll be Nazis till they die. They say they're not, but they are. They're always, you know, I got to be older and somewhat, at least imitation intellectual and a writer and traveling in fast crowds and cities and so on. And cunningly agnostic or atheistic and sitting around porch, distinguished cocktail parties, other little pukes and disgusting the farce of the belief in God. And then, if God exists, let him strike me dead. If God exists, why in Chicago does Lewis Lepke, or Three Figure Brown, rather, live in a big estate with women and frauds, and his children are happy on the edge of his estate? A train comes and hits a busload of nuns and strews them along the tracks for half a mile. Is that how God rewards his people on earth? If God exists, why does a gangster live in, a Lucky Luciano live in Italy? Women, fraud, drugs, money, drink, everything he wants. 50 miles away, the Pope dies screaming in pain from cancer. Just how God rewards his people. Ha! God is, doesn't exist. I remember reading in my imitation intellectual reading Nietzsche. And one thing that struck me about Nietzsche is one of his characters once, in one of his pieces says, God is dead. He may have existed once to set the orbs awhirl and to make the natural law. But look at about you, there's anarchy. God no longer exists. God is dead. Do not live in fear. I remember thinking, I hope that's true. I really hope that's true, because I won't have to. Because late at night when I'm afraid, I know I'm going to go to hell. Incidentally, I should say about that, there's always somebody who spoils things. Nietzsche is quoted in a theological seminary in Chicago. They have a big sign that says, God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it says, Nietzsche's dead, signed God, 1906. But I was an imitation intellectual and imitation atheist. In fact, one time in Dallas, some guys and I, we almost brought this off. We were so cute, somebody snitched on us, but we had a deal where we're going to put in the telephone book a dial of prayer for atheists, where you'd call this number and nobody would ever answer. Well, so when I began going to meetings again and staying sober, I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car right outside the club back door, so it was close to the meetings. And I didn't want to hear the story about returning to God. In fact, I remember talking one night at a meeting, I don't want to hear that crap. I may be here to get sober after this or that religious crap. I remember an old lady come up to me, she said, "Oh, son," she said, I just hate to see you fight God. I remember it took all I could do to keep from saying, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." Now you can just hear me fight God. But my sponsor and some others over a period of time educated me into that step. Remember he said, "It never says you got to return to God." I said, "Well, return to a power greater than myself, to that fool your little people around here. I have to be a little more intelligent than that." It doesn't even say that. It says you come to believe in something. You never return to anything. There's nothing in AA that says you ever return to anything, because we're coming out of sickness. The only thing about return to anything is one sentence that says, some people return to normal living. But he said a little puke like you'd never had any normal living, so you have to worry about that. And boy, I just got him. I said, "Oh, yeah." He just turned white. He says, "You got to believe in something. You got to believe in something. Can't you believe in God?" I said, "No, I don't." He says, "You believe in AA?" I said, "No, I don't." He says, "You think I'm doing better than you are?" I said, "I guess you are." He says, "Congratulations, I'm your new higher power." Now, he became my higher power, and that was acceptable to me. He could not send me to hell. He could make my life hell, but he could not send me to hell. And I just stay out of his way as much as possible. But he became my higher power. And I was so glad he did. And over a period of time, when he tricked me, and I feel bad, when he found me at the right time, and I was feeling bad enough to be pliable, he got me to take actions and do things. And little by little, I stayed sober, much to my surprise, taking those stupid actions he nailed me with. Over a time period of time, I came to believe in AA is my higher power. After I was a year and a half sober, so I can believe in AA is my higher power. That was great. And sometime after that, I found myself praying to an abstract God that I swore I would never pray to. And I came to believe in a power greater than myself. To this day, I would say this to anybody who's new. I would much rather see you believe in your sponsor that you really believe in than to pretend to believe in a God you don't believe in so you look good at the meetings. Because the time comes, it's 2 a.m. and you've got to turn to what you believe in, and if you've been shucking them, you're dead. You better have something out there that you believe in. But you've got to come to believe in something, that's all. You've got to come to believe in something. Step is quite simple. Came to believe that some power exists that meetings, AA, sponsor, God, will what? Will restore me to sanity. Now there is a... That sounds so easy to say it, but once you're an imitation intellectual, it's very difficult. It might even be true for real intellectuals. How about that, Jack? Anyway... I need to ride back to the airport. I'm just playing up to it. Sanity is a very, very difficult thing to define. You could read 10 books on mental problems and mental recoveries, and you will get 10 different definitions of what sanity is. When I was in the electric shock ward, well, very funny, huh? I was under a lot of duress, except I couldn't remember what it was. Right? There was a guy next to my bed that I always thought was one of the only man I ever knew that was happy. Really? Sane. Because he was happy all the time. I do this one, friend. Just high.
And I realized sometime later, the guy's nuts. He's never going to get out of there as long as he keeps laughing. He's going to, until he realizes how bad it is here, you know. What is that? What the hell is sanity? What does it mean that you're happy all the time, that you're well-adjusted? No. Some people live in great pain, are very sick. What the hell is it? Now, oddly enough, insanity can be defined. Sanity can't, but insanity can. Insanity, now not the insanity we talk about in AA, although that can be defined, but that's not what we're talking about. You know, they still say that, well, alcoholism is still second greatest cause of insanity, right behind syphilis. But that type of insanity is not what we're talking about here. That type of insanity is not even really insanity. It's more of a physical condition. Alcoholic insanity is when you drunk enough alcohol so the dehydrating aspects of it will desiccate, dry out enough for your brain. You call it a wet brain, it turns out to be a dry brain, so you can't function. I bet most of you have never seen a case of alcoholic insanity. You would never see them. They're not people who sit around meetings talking crazy. I see them every once in a while, and I wish I never did, but I see them a lot. They sit in a hospital ward or a bed. They just sit there. And people come and change their diapers three times a day and feed them and put them to bed and get them up and change their diapers and feed them. And it's very similar to the last stages of syphilis, except syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholic insanity, they can live like that for 40 years. And their families come down, "Don't you remember me, friend?" Mm-hmm. Away they go. Everybody cries, except the patient. That's what alcoholic insanity is. But psychotic insanity is what we're talking about now. Not brain damage insanity, but psychosis. Psychosis, of course, it has very many complexities. But just for to really overly simplify it, but still true. When the human brain, under sufficient conflict, can find no way out of the conflict, and mounts until it's intolerable, the brain, in order to survive, will lower an altered perception of reality, and that is called psychosis. The same things look different. It may be that much, which many times people can live their whole lives with some of it, or it may be this much, which puts you in the insane asylum, or variations thereof. But what psychosis really is, it's an altered perception of reality. That's truly what it is. Now, we talk sometimes in our meetings about how, well, then I was psychotic, then I wasn't, then I was, and then I wasn't. You mean you're in pain and neurosis, and then you get over it. Because once you become truly psychotic, you stay there. You don't come back. Maybe 1 in 100 million. But true psychosis is a permanent condition. Now, it's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that amazing? You'd think you'd be one of the leaders of the psychotic group. The incidence of alcoholics becoming psychotic are infinitesimal. Why is that? They certainly have a great deal of conflict. They have a great deal of pain. They live in neurotic conflict constantly, it seems like. Obsessive, unresolved problems. Because of one thing. They have an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Now, this unnatural reaction has been, when you're listening to meetings, people discuss, well, I stayed drunk 25 years, and that's the unnatural reaction, or I acted crazier. All of these are offshoots. The unnatural reaction of alcohol in the alcoholic, it must have the power to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It's hard to realize it doesn't do that for other people. That's why they don't drink. It's not a matter of morality or goodness. As has been, you know, I remember I was about a year sober. I finally had a little job working in the advertising agency again, wrapping packages, the same kind of job I'd had when I was 14 years old, part of the AA Rocket to Stardom program. No front teeth, sullen. But one of our accounts, there was something called Kamchatka Vodka. And they had billboards all over Southern California. I never saw them anywhere else, but they had them all over Southern California. They had the same billboard year after year. Vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. and they do different colors and different styles, different lands, but it's always the same. And I had been a writer. I had been an award-winning advertising writer until I was buried by bad breaks and misunderstandings. And so I decided to make my move. One day I kept out my packages. I'm going to let them know there is a keen George Washington Hill type advertising wizard back in that wrapping room. Art director, town executive laying out this same billboard, different style, same way. And I said, none of my business. But I got an idea. How is this for a slogan? Kamchatka vodka goes boom. Better than all vodkas everywhere. And they all looked at me with the same look I've been getting my whole life. Just and one guy said, that's supposed to be funny. And I said, you don't even have an ugly mouth, it's a stupid mouth. And things like that. I don't know any single feeling that ever made me feel worse than public humiliation. Oh. You think that's funny? You're always sorry right after. Oh, sorry, miss. That's why I don't allow people I sponsor their own guns, because there ain't nobody who doesn't have that surge once in a while. But I was really, they were kind of short and rather effeminate. I would about to go over the table and get them. I thought I could handle them, at least the art director. But I thought, I'll have to explain to that damn power drunk sponsor of mine, I'd rather face death than do that. So I just went off and I almost quit the job. I just half crazed. I didn't run away. I knew my sponsor would help me on this. I saw him that night and I said, Bob! Hold it down, for Christ's sake. If you can't be a man, act like one. Don't I? So for God's sakes, kid, how many times do I have to tell this to you? They're not putting you down. They're not abusing you. You're not a damn victim. They don't know what the hell you're talking about. Can't you understand this? When they drink, alcohol goes... When you and I drink, it goes... Boom! That's why we're in this meeting and they're not.
I could have told you that.
But that's always been an excellent test to me, people. Might be carried away with their graduation exercises from AA. Hey, I'm not really an alcoholic. Maybe I'm a situational drinker. Maybe it's all her fault. Now that she's been shaped up, it'll be different. All the thought is this. Would you like to spend your life, or have liked to spend your life, when the day has come when your back is to the wall and the hounds of fate are ripping at your throat? Oh, God, give me a drink. Would you really want it to go... Oh, no more for me. I'm starting to feel it. But if you are like me, when your back is to the wall and the hounds of fate are ripping at your throat, give me a drink. It doesn't go... Bring on your goddamn hound, Mrs. Baskerville. This is an unnatural effect. Eventually that becomes a trauma in itself. But a case can well be made. If we had a lot of time, I'm sure I'd be glad to debate it. And in other words, I can say alcohol has the power to induce temporary psychosis within me. It alters my perception of reality, as psychosis does for all troubled minds. In fact, scientists who study alcoholics say alcoholics sometimes have to drink to preserve their sanity. Without temporarily inducing chemical insanity, I'm in danger of becoming psychotic. So, I can induce psychosis. And I never do it, nor does anybody around me know it. And my life is a shambles thereof. Because one day the psychosis gets to me, the only relief I have from this pain. And then I wind up in that position again. Intolerable sobriety, intolerable drinking. But none of that is germane at this step. Because this step we don't have to know much. All I have to admit is that somehow I have to come to believe that something or somebody, I don't even have to know why or how it's going to happen. People always want to know why. This step doesn't concern the why. Just come to believe that somehow it's going to happen somehow. Maybe a tongue of fire is going to land on your nose. Who knows? I guess it's on your shoulder, actually. When you're Norwegian, they take the biggest thing available. Come to believe that a power greater than myself will restore me to sanity. And I certainly construe sanity the ability to live without having to induce psychosis. That is the definition of sanity by any term, medically or psychiatrically. Sanity, the ability to live in reality with some degree of equanimity and at least the ability to withstand the vicissitudes of reality. So, second step is really not very tough. I have to come to believe somehow that there's something here that's going to make me not have to drink. That's all it means. We read so many things in these steps. The first two steps are very quite simple. I have to admit I had trouble with my drinking. For some reason I can't understand. I had trouble with sobriety for reasons that was their fault. And I can prove it's their fault, but I don't care whose fault it was. But I had some trouble with sobriety. And the second step, I got to try to somehow come to believe that there may be some power that I can't see or understand yet is going to make it all right. I can't see how. And really, when you walk into the room, you have taken those two steps, in effect. Because if you didn't think you had the problems, you wouldn't be here. And if you didn't think there was some help here, you wouldn't be here either. You may disbelieve it later, but these are really non-debatable steps as they're written. They are debatable only with implications and unnatural inferences. So, nothing difficult there. Then the third step. Now this really, there's no way out of this one. It's just... made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understand. There he is now. I had to come to believe, and I still believe, in a varying way, that all that means is that I must be willing, based on the two premises that come before it, to surrender enough to try the things that I laboriously came to believe in the second step. That wherever this power may be, sponsor, meeting, AA, God, that I'm going to have, I'm not, when I say I'm turning my life over to the care of God, you know, the worst thing I can think of to happen when people sit around and say, well, I'm in God's hands, it's up to His responsibility. Not at all. I just, it makes me sad to see people do that. Because I think it's a very great truism. God will never do for you what you could do for yourself. That's what we're here for. If you're sitting there waiting for him to pay your rent, you got a long wait. I got a guy that I sponsor who, against my wishes, got a new station wagon because God told him to. But unfortunately, God didn't keep up the payment, so he lost that station wagon. But we like to blame God for everything, but... I had to come to believe. And what that means is surrender, the most difficult single surrender I know in the world. And that is the surrender of my judgment of what is right for me. I'll tell you, we can talk all day about, yes, these wonderful precepts, these wonderful things, but when it gets down to 2 o'clock in the morning and I can hear the hounds baying outside, I haven't got time for theory now. I better watch out for number one. And always reminds me, you know, in the early days of aircraft, these flimsy little things flying around, Wright Brothers and those guys. And in the early days, one of the worst things, the worst thing that happened to you once you got up in the air was to get into a tailspin. Because there was no way to pull out of a tailspin, those damn things. You know, that little stick, you try to pull the nose up. And they'd just dig them out of the ground, pry their hands loose, because they'd be dead in the ground. And one day, about 1910, a young lieutenant named Alfred Selfridge, I think was his name, who later died, but he got in a tailspin, pardon me, and he was up at some tremendous height, like 600 feet. And, that may not seem high to you young folks on drugs. Hey, let me write that one down. And he tried to pull down, he couldn't, and the plane was moving, so he tried to do anything he could. Let's get it over with quick. And he pushed the stick forward, which makes the nose go down, and you crash faster. And that day they discovered how you pull out a tailspin, and you still do it the same way. You come out the other way. Today they do the same thing with a jet. Right rudder, and full power, and go underneath. But, now, many of the people who had learned to fly already discovered that. But after that, there were still people being dug out of the ground. They knew how to dip out of a tailspin, but once they got in a tailspin, there's no time for theory. I got to pull this son of a bitch up. And away they go. But eventually they come out the other side. And I'm sure that's what it is for all of us. We all know how to surrender, and we talk about surrender. It's very easy to surrender when things are going good. When you got a fistful of 50s and you're tap dancing through the streets. A little bit different when they're looking at you funny at the YMCA. The hardest surrender I know of is to take actions that I knew of, but isn't anymore, because it worked no better, I think. But to take actions I don't believe in, predicated on somebody else's analysis of my problem. Man, I know you mean well, but you just don't understand. And I think if you're like me, a number of times over the years, I have been very close to the ground before I push the stick forward. There have been grass stains. See, it wore the hair off my head just skimming along the ground there for a while. And that's a continuing surrender, you know, and that's one of the things we have to do again and again. Basic surrenders, I think that's sometimes newer people, even older people, get the wrong impression. They think of some sort of a mystic, lifelong thing. Because you hear old timers get the point of saying, well, I came here, and I threw in the towel. Yeah, it's just been pretty wonderful ever since then. That's podium talk. I'll tell you what life is. You throw in the towel, and when the heat dwindles, you take that baby back. And you spend the rest of your natural life tearing off small strips. How much do they want of me, for God's sake? And that's why old-timers have to tear off strips, just like newcomers have to tear off strips. Because the imitation equanimity of old-timers, they get doing so well that when bad times come, they know it can't be anything within them anymore. It must be something else because they're authorities. When they make mistakes, just the same as new people, there's a basic law, I think, in the survival. Making mistakes do not get you drunk. Does not get you drunk, ever. If making mistakes got you drunk, we all would be drunk. Sinning does not get you drunk. Being bad doesn't get you drunk. What gets you drunk is defending it and trying to prove it's all right. And that's why our step, we have a step just devoted practically to continuing to admit our error and our sins and our faults and our mistakes and wrongdoing. But all of these things are part of the conducive continuing surrender. But the big surrender in the third step, to be very simple, goes right back to what we're talking about. I've admitted I've had some problems drinking, although I don't think my problem is really alcohol. And, of course, as we understand, it really isn't. It's alcoholism, which is a double problem of drinking and sobriety. And I've had some problems in my sobriety. And I've tried to come to believe that Bob or my home group, or God, or AA in some abstract way, will give me some way so I can live comfortably. I don't see how it can be, but I'm going to try. And then I'm going to try to do what they tell me. Even though I don't believe in it, I'm going to try to do what they tell me. The hardest single surrender in my life, and I believe in most of ours. Once it's over, it seems like nothing. You've got to remember, your whole fiber of your being is... That's why people slip and die. Because they cannot believe that you can know more than I do about me, and I must use my judgment. The surrender of judgment is the hardest surrender of any human being. And especially an insecure and frightened one. Because they must keep the walls up higher than most. And so the first three steps really have driven a lot of people away. Because they misunderstand them. They don't know what they say. They say, oh, come here and admit I'm drunk and that's made me screwed up and God's going to make it better and that's going to be all right. Baloney. And they die without ever knowing and ever understood what they were about. And I'll tell you, as long as you get sober, as long as I'm sober, for many years now, I've been sober 33 years, these three steps have been a continuing trampoline in my sobriety. Whenever I get carried away with my crap sometimes, I get really feeling bad. You go back to, well, what am I doing here? Is my mission to save souls? To help other alcoholics? I'm well known. I'm Clancy Arkham up the sky. I've got to be something. No, I'll tell you why I'm here. Because of myself, I can't stand the drink, and sobriety's unbearable. And somehow there's a power greater than myself. God damn it, that's going to make it all right. So I guess I better do that crap again. And it starts to get better. I've used that trampoline again and again. I've always been a little in awe of people who just take all the steps once or take the first nine steps. To me, I'm weak and heavy laden some days, sometimes from victory as well as defeat. And I have to have memories and remember who I am. I'm just a guy who's got a problem with drinking, a problem with sobriety, and a problem with life. And here there's a power to help me. I better surrender and try it again. And it's all worthwhile. Thank you.